to ease down by the end of the night, and it should remain largely frost-free. For Thursday, an improving picture with lighter winds and more in the way of sunshine developing. However, late in the day, more wind and rain will arrive across the south of England and Wales and move northwards during the night, risk of more flooding here. Friday, slowly improving once again with sunshine and showers, these frequent in the west, but it is a window of fine weather as by Saturday, the next stormy spell of rain and gales moves in.
All right, many thanks, Stav Daneus. Time now for our book of the week. Sally Magnusson continues reading Where Memories Go, her moving account of her mother Mamie Baird's 8-year struggle with dementia. A pioneering Scottish journalist, Mamie went on to marry the writer and broadcaster Magnus Magnusson, with whom she had 5 children. In today's episode, despite the telltale warning signs, Sally and her family are still struggling to acknowledge that all is not well with Mamie.
In 1953, a successful young journalist for the Scottish Daily Express, you were in the Edinburgh office to cover the International Festival when an exotic figure with blonde hair, a reddish beard and a blazer followed you to lunch. "Who's the character with the beard?" you ask a colleague. "Magnus Magnusson," he whispers. "What? Nobody's a name like that." You're told he's from Iceland, and he speaks with a soft Oxford accent you rather like. You are definitely interested. Magnus was living at home and trying to fund his postgraduate studies through freelance writing. His family had moved to Edinburgh from Reykjavik in 1930, when he was 8 months old. It's hard to think of another job in the early 50s in which a girl from your background, the daughter of factory workers in Rutherglen, south of Glasgow, could have ended up in the same office as an Oxford graduate, earning not only more than him, but considerably more than the other men too. In journalism, the nose for a story was valued more than a university degree, and writing ability took precedence over gender. "We fell for each other," you said, "instantly. We were going about Edinburgh in a kind of dwam." Why did I never talk to my father about what was happening to you? I think we each hoped the other might not have noticed. Or perhaps we were too busy trying not to notice ourselves, believing that the longer we went without acknowledging it, the longer life would remain more or less normal. In any case, it was easier than in most households for everyone to adjust around you. Your twin sister, Anna, had become a fixture of your home from the moment she'd given up her job as a hotel manageress and moved in to help with your babies 40 years ago. This is why it took us longer than it might have in a more conventional home to begin to register how very, very little you were doing and how far you'd withdrawn from household decisions of any kind and anything practical whatsoever. You stopped writing. When did that happen? All my life you'd been dashing off something on the typewriter. Words were the air you breathed. Words, from the age of 17, were what you did. I can't think why none of us thought it remarkable that your productivity had dried up so completely. What probably made it less obvious was that you retained your sparkling interest in words themselves, in their meaning, their sound, their spelling, punning potential, beauty or plainness, an interest that even now continues to flash. Perhaps that's what fooled us into thinking for a long time, that you'd still be able to put those words together on paper, if only you felt like it. How much did my father know? I have no idea, but he must have noticed that you were changing. No more hopping on a plane to visit grandchildren or whizzing round the garden on your once-prized sit-on lawnmower. No more, in fact, of so much that we all used to take for granted, as we did your laid-back, easy-going personality, so different from your twin sister Anna's more anxious disposition, and my father's volatile temperament with his periodic Nordic glooms. While never referring directly to what were clearly the symptoms of early dementia, my father did find a word for how you seemed at these times. Distrait, he called it. In this, he chose, as usual, well. It's from the Latin, distrahere, to pull apart. In the episodes of distraction we were observing, in the cloud of vagueness that had begun to settle around you, it uncannily captures the loss of crucial connections in your brain. It felt to us at the time like a slippage of moorings. I imagined you as a small boat bobbing away inexorably towards the grey mist. Dementia. I hate the name. At least Alzheimer's disease arrives on the tongue with solid Germanic probity. It may be a mouthful, but it has the air of a sober, respectable ailment that can show its face in company. Dementia's different. It's feckless and French. It hisses and seethes. It conjures up madness, asylums, insanity, lunacy, something inchoate and uncontainable and dangerous. Dementia itself is a syndrome, not a disease. It's caused by a number of illnesses in which there's progressive decline in multiple areas of function, including memory, reasoning, communication skills, and the ability to carry out daily activities. Many people will not have the form that Alois Alzheimer was first to identify, but rather vascular dementia, the second most common type, caused by impaired circulation of blood around the brain. The stigma around dementia is what keeps people isolated, reluctant to admit to symptoms and terrified of being branded. Dementia, the word I avoided for years out of cowardice because I could not bring myself to associate it with you. Dementia, the word that will only be redeemed if people like me use it, and people like you, my radiant, light-hearted mother, lead lives that defy its stigma for as long as you and they possibly can. In May 2004, my father is rushed to hospital for tests on his bowel. Once there, and before a scan can be completed, a giant ulcer in his colon bursts, resulting in septicemia and systematic organ failure. He may not make it through the night, the portly intensive care consultant tells us. But he's alive. And you, our mother, are keeping us going. Your optimism, even though hardly warranted by the doctor's careful phrases, cannot be dented. We find ourselves like children again, following your lead. You refuse to leave him, and we take turns to join you. You remind him it will be your 50th wedding anniversary in a few weeks' time, and you want him there for it. When one or other of us starts to drift into despair, you simply will not allow it. Mum's back, we whisper to each other. I realise now it was never as simple as that. You had not miraculously returned either to full mental vigour or to what we routinely thought of now as your old self. Rather, the gradual pulling apart of your selfhood was serving you well as a coping mechanism. When emergency jolted you into full engagement, the inconvenient medical niceties went straight over your head, but the old optimism, strength and fight that had always served you in a crisis surged back. There are times in life, so sweet and so precious, that even as we live them, they've acquired the lustre of memory. 2 years, near enough. A golden 2 years between the ulcer that nearly killed my father in May 2004 and the cancer that actually did. 2 years when your mind still, more or less, held together. A gentle enough time in which he voluntarily slowed down for the first time in his life and, to our astonishment, discovered how to relax. At precisely the same time each morning, into the car the two of you would get, eventually, after you had taken an age to fuss around locating your coat and bag, and he had hung around at the front door waiting for you with what for him was a passable imitation of patience. The pair of you would settle at a table in the central precinct and sip tea and coffee as the world wandered by. A motley collection of local figures began joining you, among whom Dad held court, puffing thoughtfully on his pipe. You were in your element at his side. You basked in the attentions of an undemanding audience and the reassuring nearness of my father. And most importantly, this excursion gave a purpose and focus to your day that helped counter the feelings of lostness. You felt you were tending to him, while he was, in reality, quietly looking out for you. He understood the comfort you felt in being with him. You, on the other hand, did not sense what was happening at precisely the same time to him. You didn't notice, as once you certainly would have, when he began to show signs of a different kind of weakness. You were not aware of the way his favourite tweed jacket was starting to hang off him as he sat, chin cupped in his right hand, pipe and ashtray at the ready by his left, contemplating the passing scene. This is how he's sitting the day I walk around the corner and am shaken by a gust of both happiness and loss as I catch sight of your group in the distance. You're next to him as usual, chic in the creamy woolen Icelandic coat he bought for you many moons ago on a trip to the homeland. You're leaning towards him, laughing. I linger on my corner, drinking in the scene. The sight of my parents together, happy, and, from a distance, whole. And yet, I know. Of course I know. At the very moment the happiness bubbles into my throat, I know it is about to end. Despite the sheen with which memory has burnished those 2 years, your dementia did progress. You were often listless, your get up and go, as you complained mournfully, having determinedly got up and gone. Instead, your energy was directed into angry outbursts against your bewildered twin sister. Many a day, one of us would call in to find the house sagging with misery, and at the same time, electric with tension. Although my father knew you were struggling, he remained reluctant to bestow solidity on the monster by giving it a name. They were only hints and unspoken understandings. Once he took me aside to ask if I could buy you a dress to wear to a posh function. At the official dinners to which he was forever being invited, you had always been an asset. You could talk to anyone, remember the names of acquaintances he had forgotten, remind him surreptitiously of the punchline to any joke upon which he had recklessly embarked, and be relied upon to start up a song if the table needed enlivening. Now, he said, there was a dinner coming up at which you would be just a little on show. I remember how hesitantly he said this. At the time, I was too obtuse, too busy, or perhaps too afraid of peering under a scab he was clearly keen not to open, to say more than, "Yes, of course I will." How long had he been worrying about you on those public occasions? How long had he been quietly rescuing you from conversations in which you'd lost your way? And when did he start noticing that you had not bought yourself anything new at all for a very long time? Tempting you out shopping was a trial. Still, I propelled you to the shops at last, and we bought a floaty summer dress in which you looked fantastic. When the night of the dinner came round, my sister Topsy and I laid everything out for you in your bed, made sure you didn't forget your lipstick, and led you downstairs like a bride. Dad was waiting for you at the bottom. He beamed when he saw you.
Tomorrow, Sally Magnuson continues reading her memoir, Where Memories Go. It was abridged by Sarah Davies and produced by Justine Willett. Now here's Sailing By to take us to the shipping forecast. And now on BBC Radio 4, the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Wednesday, the 5th of February. There are warnings of gales in all areas. The general synopsis at 1800. Low Shannon 946, expected Irish Sea 964 by 1800 Wednesday. New low expected 400 miles west of Fitzroy 973 by same time. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours. Viking, North at Sarah, South at Sarah, Forties, Cromarty, Forth, Tyne, Dogger. Southerly or southeasterly 7 to severe gale 9, rain or showers, moderate or good. Fisher, German Bight, southeast 6 to gale 8, occasional rain, moderate or good in west, moderate or poor in east. Humber, Thames, Dover, southeast veering.